Okay. Hello. Good afternoon or evening, everybody. My name is Michal Kopeček. I am historian from Prague, from the Institute of Contemporary History, and I'm also a member of the project that is actually organizing this forum, which is a Volkswagen Foundation founded project called "Towards Illiberal Constitutionalism in East Central Europe: Historical Analysis in Comparative and Transnational Perspective." Now, what we have today is a first of a so-called expert forum in this beautiful setting in the House of Encounters with History, which is a first of its kind. The idea is to organize, along the sort of project meetings, to organize this fora as a, some kind of intersection between academic and scholarly discussion, more political discussion, and let's say even public or practical and practice oriented discussion. These fora are planned to take place actually in everywhere where we are meeting. We are five institutions involved in the project: University of Vienna, University of Erfurt, Warsaw University, the Sociology Department, Democracy Institute in Budapest, and the Prague Institute for Contemporary History. So, as I said, this is the first of the fora. Just a few words about the project. What we aim is to introduce somewhat more historical perspective into the current debate about the rise of illiberal politics and its accompanying constitutionalism in East Central Europe and Europe. If I may put it in a nutshell, the beginning wonder was actually how come that the same people who were at the front of the fight for democracy and somewhat also in the rows of people supporting the liberal democracy building after 1989, that some of them are actually now on the other side of barricade. So this was the sort of like initial incentive, and this is why we set up this project that is historical, but at the same time is necessarily supposed to be interdisciplinary. We have not just historians, but also sociologists, constitutional lawyers, and others in our rows. It is also more not just like ideas, but also practice and practice-oriented analysis. We're supposed to be part of the project, so we are not interested only what was written and said, but we are also interested very much on how these things and how things are being done. And this is also why we really want to get as much input from the, let's say, practical side of the thing. And this is comparative project, as you understand from the institutions involved, which is covering Central Europe, Germany, and the mostly the Visegrad countries. Historical perspective means, yeah, stretching out somewhat longer than is usually a part of the debate. That is the post-war period, with stress on the post-68 periods. That is late socialism, the liberal democratic transformation, and also nowadays what's happening, the challenge to liberal democracy. So this Warsaw Forum is the first one, and we decided that we would very much like to focus on the comparisons of the two countries that are sort of looming large in the discussion on illiberal constitutionalism. That is Poland and Hungary. And this is why we are so, or I am so grateful, and I'm also honored to have the opportunity to moderate the discussion. We are grateful to Marta Buchholz and Naum Trajanowski, who are the members of the project in here in Warsaw, that they gathered this fantastic panel. We were supposed to sit here in the number of five, which unfortunately we are not. You see just the screen of Adam Bodnar, the first of the speakers, who cannot join us due to the COVID situation in his household. Adam Bodnar, whom everybody knows probably in this room, is a lawyer and a professor at the University of Social Science and Humanities in Warsaw. And of course, he has also the invaluable experience as the ombudsman in Poland in 2015 to 2021. We have Michal Kaczmarczyk. I go alphabetically. Michal Kaczmarczyk is a sociologist and lawyer, associate professor at the University of Gdańsk. We have Renata Uitz, who is a constitutional lawyer and professor at the Central European University in Vienna, and also vice president, vice chair, co-director of the Democracy Institute and in Budapest. And we have added Skut Przybylska, who is a political scientist and a doctoral researcher, finishing her her thesis now at the Institute of Sociology, Philosophy and Sociology of the Academy of Sciences here in Poland. She's also a vice president of Amnesty International in Hungary. Now, I deliberately was not really speaking very long about our speakers, because I want to give them first the floor to sort of like introduce themselves on their own, to tell us perhaps from which position right now they are coming to our discussion on the illiberal politics and illiberal constitutions and the developments in Hungary and Poland today, and maybe to tell us what they in their work and current work see as one of the main challenges or dangers in the development that we are seeing. And maybe I would give floor first to you, Edit.
Thank you. Thank you, Michal, and also thanks to Marta and Naum for hosting us and you know, bringing us together for this conversation. It's a little bit awkward that I'm going to speak first, because I think I'm a bit odd one out in the panel. I'm the only one who is not having a legal lawyer kind of disciplinary background. I'm a political scientist. I'm doing my PhD in sociology. And my field of research is something which is, to explain it, I would need to step back from the constitutional legal side of the problem that we are experiencing in Poland and Hungary with regards to democratic backsliding. And I think these two countries are specifically problematic in Central and Eastern Europe, because this region is a hotbed of non-democratic type of informalities. I'm thinking about corruption, clientelism, structurally clientelist corruption. And although Viktor Orban changed the constitution like 10 times in the country, which is problematic as it gets, but I think that the nature of democratic backsliding in Hungary is not primarily defined by legal means. And what do I mean by that? It means that informal power is something with which the Hungarian government is maneuvering under the radar of the European Union. And by informal power, I mean like the government is tilting the playing field in this country with clientelist corruption, with media capture, and with electoral clientelism all at once. So both on the organizational and the electoral side of the clientelistic nature of the regime. And I think this is like a textbook case in the European Union, because the way how the government is, for instance, capturing the state with the allies with political and business allies, this is like outstanding. I mean, we have been witnessing many problems in Poland when it comes to organizational clientelism, but the full monopolization of corruption and the market and the state, this is something which is, I think, makes Hungary a unique example within the region. And this is tricky, because very often this is not happening the way that the government is formally violating the rule of law. So very often, the legislative measures that they're taking are in accordance with the national legislation. This is also partly because, you know, they have constitutional majority, but they're very often trying to focus on not to explicitly violate the law, like it's happening in Poland, for instance, very often. So this is something which is, I think, very not only difficult to conceptualize very often from the legal perspective, but it's also very difficult for the EU institutions to address it, because the European Union is operating in a very legally established kind of formal way. And even if it has tools, very often there is a lack of political will to address this problem the proper way. To give you one example, because I'm, you know, investigating media capture informally in these countries. This is huge, not only in Hungary, but also in Poland, that, for instance, the government is informally weaponizing state advertisement and channeling the state funds towards pro-government media outlets. So this is a given fact. We have been witnessing it in Hungary, also in Poland. And despite that this is hugely undermining media freedom in my country, but here as well. And there have been many notions initiated by, you know, different media outlets towards the European Commission. European Commission says, we cannot launch an infringement procedure. We cannot address this problem legally because formally the Hungarian government is not violating the law, not violating the EU law. But at the end of the day, everybody knows that this is what's happening. I mean, they're undermining democracy by tilting the playing field, by supporting financially their media outlets and bleeding out others which are independent of the government. And end of the day, the problem is that this is not only about the media freedom, this is undermining the integrity of the elections as well. So we are addressing two problems here. One of them is misuse of state aid. One of them is the misuse of, you know, the competition kind of like law. Two, so to say, like territories where the European Commission should have and has competences, but they don't do anything about it. And I think it's a problem. And I think this is exactly the nature of the problem that we need to figure and we need to deal with when it comes to democratic backsliding in Central and Eastern Europe. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. You got right into the middle of the things. Thanks a lot. Adam, I would like to give floor to you. Thank you once again for joining us, even with COVID.
Yeah. I'm very sorry for this. You know, I would really love to meet you and to discuss not only during the panel but also afterwards different issues. I think the Polish case, as you know, is a different one than Hungary, and I hope that we'll have a chance to discuss differences. On the other hand, Hungary is a role model for Poland. So I think that we should remember that everything started in Poland with words by Jarosław Kaczyński, that he's going to build Budapest in Warsaw. And starting from 2015, we have experienced this so-called salami tactics of cutting independence of different institutions. We have observed the rebuilding of the state according to some kind of a new vision. And right now, after 7 years, we are in a situation when number of independent institutions are taken over, or at least they are chilled to that extent that they cannot operate with full independence. I think what is quite interesting about Poland is that, first of all, Poland became, to greater extent than Hungary, in my opinion, a laboratory of, let's say, legal exchange and political exchange with the European Union. So if you look back into the process, you see that European Union is not only reacting by using different political means and legal instruments, but also is at the same time developing those techniques. And of course, it creates a very interesting problem from the point of view of legitimacy, because sometimes you might ask a question whether the European Union is fully equipped to do this and whether the EU is not going too far with some of those actions. And moreover, if you look into some judgments, into some positions, they are becoming very much progressive. From the legal point of view, for example, the case concerning so-called Portuguese Judges Association, so the case from the February 2018, was a real breakthrough. But before, European Union didn't have this power, or at least it was not stipulated like this, that the EU Court of Justice is going to control the operation and the construction of the judiciary in EU member states. And in fact, when you compare this to the situation of the Hungarian judiciary, before this case, EU was not so active regarding the Hungarian judiciary. So I think it is quite interesting because it created a tension and it created a conflict. And basically, we observe the results of this conflict until today because of the suspension of the EU recovery fund with respect to Poland, and basically quite unclear future what may happen next. I think the second interesting situation is regarding the position of the Polish civil society, because the Polish civil society reacted quite strongly. In my opinion, it could reacted even stronger, but still, I think everything what has been achieved until today shows a certain certain degree of sympathy and understanding for the rule of law cause. And I think what is interesting from the scholar perspective is to look why the civil society in Poland was so reactive and was so resilient in terms of protesting against rule of law changes and also in terms of creating some machinery instruments. In my opinion, one of the reasons for this is because it could rely on some practices from 70s, from 80s, and also because of the fact that we had some kind of a tradition of the rule of law even before 89, maybe also coming from the interwar period, or maybe even from some previous centuries, like this tradition of the constitution of the 3rd May of 1791. I think it is quite interesting issue to look at it. And I think the third point, and maybe I will refer here to what Edith said, is you cannot defend rule of law, in my opinion, when you do not have some spaces of pluralism. And despite different attacks, not only civil society, but also media provided a room for the discussion. Obviously, media became a victim of this because media were also attacked. But still, I have a feeling that still we have some spaces of discussion. Of course, the public discussion is a little bit kind of shaken because of the domination over state media as well as financially dependent media that operate in Poland. But nevertheless, it gives you some kind of a chance for the real discussion on some important issues. Also, in meantime, some changes concerning how the people use media happened, which also creates a change in the public discourse. So I would like to add this this element. And final point, we shouldn't miss in this discussion about the rule of law, this relationship between not only, because sometimes it is presented like the member state European Union. I think other international organizations also matter. Just look at, you know, I was really fascinated by reading report by Professor Angelika Nussberger, who was the rapporteur of the so-called OSCE Moscow mechanism, and she prepared a report on Russia, how fundamental rights and political freedoms, as well as the civil society operation, has been undermined in Russia over the last 10 years, because she was mostly referring to the Bolotnaya Square events, but also this report covers the whole 30 years period. Why I mention this? Because this is the OSCE report. European Court of Human Rights had a lot to say regarding Russia, but it also had is having a lot to say regarding Poland. But what is quite interesting is that if you read this report, I have a feeling that basically you are reading the report also on Poland, because some of the practices that were negative with respect to the civil society, this whole concept of the shrinking space for the civil society, were very much the same in Poland in terms of intimidation of journalists, creation of gongos, in terms of using the strategic lawsuits against public participation, as well as passing of legislation that is chilling freedom of speech. So in my opinion, I think it is quite interesting, because sometimes we tend to concentrate on this relationship between, let's say, like the on those institutional reforms and the counteraction by the European Union, and we do forget that all of this operates in a certain public space, in a certain civil society space, and that practices that are used here are to great extent a repetition of practices from some other sorry to say it, authoritarian countries. So I think this it is, in my opinion, quite interesting perspective that we should address rule of law not just as a kind of a single issue, but in a much broader environment of looking into it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was thank you for all the statements. It was already a lot of food for thinking. Now, Renata, could you pick up on it?
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Mikael, and thank you very much both to Edith and Adam for setting the scene. I thought that it might be helpful to speak briefly about what this perspective on illiberal practices is about. And to take two steps back, I mean, Adam and I are both from the generation who were coming to age during the third wave of democratization, where quite a bit of constitutional transition happened in terms of adopting good practice solutions, learning from our Western peers, and living up to European expectations, both in the Council of Europe and in the EU. And it was very much a legally formalized process, where there was where the big achievements were understood to be in terms of formal changes to black letter law. And what we do realize now, and Hungary definitely started it earlier than Poland, is that these formal changes do not necessarily reflect or were translated into deep-seated political values and social practices, how people live and what people think. So the practice perspective which this project adopts does take a look at legal forms and how legal forms are used in context. And one of the most important elements of this perspective is that we are able to take timing into account. So to give you a sense of why timing matters, a tiny example from the last 2 weeks in Hungary. Probably those of you who follow the rule of law space would know that the European Parliament adopted a very important resolution saying for the first time that Hungary is not a full-fledged democracy anymore. On the day when this resolution was starting to be debated, the Hungarian Official Journal printed a decree by the Minister of Interior changing the terms of how the types of checks women seeking a legal and otherwise legal abortion have to be submitted themselves to, including how women have to listen to fetal heartbeats and also have to be shown the ultrasound picture of the fetus. On the day when the European Parliament voted on the resolution with an overwhelming majority, this new requirement on women having to listen to the fetal heartbeat entered into force. So if I tell you about the heartbeat requirement, you are telling me that they are copying Texas. But if I give you the other layer of the European political event, then you understand that there is plenty of learning on a global scale, way beyond Europe. A practice perspective permits us to look at the legal rules, but permits us also to look at the interconnections and their impact on the ground. Now, in terms of what Adam was saying, he was very polite in saying that Hungary is the role model for Poland, but that can only happen because, of course, you are one electoral cycle behind. So we can serve as a role model just as a matter of a historic accident. And frankly, Poland is very often being a lot more bold and a lot more radical when it comes to illiberal innovations. What Hungary brings to the family dinner is borrowing from Russia a lot more directly and a lot more openly. And that is because the Hungarian government cultivated closer ties with Russia. So we are a lot more open about where the sources of inspiration are from. And I think what we are overlooking sometimes in the discussion is the impact of the good Hungarian relations with China and in Central Asia through the Turkey Council. There is plenty of opportunity to learn from these contexts, which are not part of the debate when you focus on the EU rule of law dimension. Adam mentioned civil society, where we agree. What you did not highlight that much is that in Poland, you still, after so many years, have a lot more energy when it comes to public contestations and protests in the public square. And this is where Edith's research is very important, because Hungarian apathy, I think, is in part explained by the extent to which Hungarian public square is saturated in government propaganda due to media reform. And so that's one element which a practice perspective can take into account. And last but not least, and this is probably where we disagree with Edith a little bit, because you said that, you know, informal practices matter a lot more. I would say that in the last few years, before and definitely after the elections, formal legal changes in the Hungarian constitutional and legal space have a certain degree of self-confidence, which we haven't seen in the first 10 years. So legislation on the propaganda of homosexuality, the constitutional amendment on gender identity and declaring that the father is a man, the mother is a woman, is a very clear, bold expression of illiberal Christian democratic values in the constitutional text. So, and this boldness is explained in my book, at least in part, with the EU's trepidation to respond, that even there is a positive response, like, you know, Poland gets its daily fine from the ECJ. The next day, the Commission comes out to say that, oh, don't worry, we will subtract it from the next handout, so you don't actually have to pay for that. So that trepidation, of course, feeds boldness. And the other dimension, which I think is equally important, is that we see emerging global alliances. So national exceptionalism and a strong emphasis on constitutional sovereignty is translated into a value-based bilateralism where friendship networks are built on a global scale. President Bolsonaro, who is about to stand an election, visited Budapest right after he went to Moscow. These good relations between the Hungarian president of the Republic, Bolsonaro, and then American Republican circles result in a fine exchange, regular meetings and exchanges of ideas about traditional values and family values, where the Polish influence is further enlarged in the Hungarian public discourse with a much more global set of ideas on how to build an illiberal democracy on Christian values.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Vitrinata. We always move from East Central Europe to a much more global comparative setting. Thank you for that. Last but not least, Michal, I give the floor to you now.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk here. I basically share a lot of ideas which have been put forth here in the discussion. I basically tend to think in general terms about societies and about the social processes. And I also see happening something really dangerous in the world right now. I think that the crisis of democracy is a global phenomenon. So I share your opinion. For example, in the pretty good democracy index of the journal The Economist, the number of democracies in the world is decreasing rapidly in the last decade. So I think we should really stress the fact that we have to do with a global phenomenon of authoritarianism. We have to do with something like a radical right international. I would name it strongly. It's a radical right international, but it has different dimensions which we should distinguish, I think. The first dimension, which is obvious, which we are talking about, is authoritarianism, attack on constitutions and all the problems we are dealing with. But there are also two other dimensions, I think. The first one is nationalism. It has been mentioned here already, which legitimizes certain attacks on the rule of law. And the third is populism. Populism, which is a tool, which is a form, which can lead to authoritarianism, but may be also used by other political groups, not only by authoritarians. But in practice, in the radical right, these three elements are closely interrelated. And populism leads to authoritarianism, where authoritarianism is legitimated by nationalism, which, of course, provokes sociological questions. What's the social base of this kind of radical right international? And I think there are different hypotheses, different answers to the question. The one are changes in the social structure. From my perspective, one important phenomenon which may be responsible for the process is the emergence of the so-called new middle class, which leaves the old middle class a little bit in resentment, kind of backlash against the rise of the new cosmopolitan middle class, maybe one of the causes. Another observation I would like to make is the different distribution of social knowledge in the modern world, the emergence of internet, and processes which are pretty complex, difficult to understand, but have to do with inclusion and exclusion processes. Our societies are not as homogeneous as they were like 2-3 decades ago anymore, are much more disconnected. People feel much more isolated, much more lonely. And that makes me think about Hannah Arendt and her The Origins of Totalitarianism, because she pointed to exactly these phenomena as causes of totalitarianism. I don't want to talk about it in detail, but let me add one more observation about constitutions. I actually share the idea that constitutions are not just parts of the legal systems, of the legal order. They are much more than that. They are also practices and values. And what makes them viable, what allows societies to defend constitutions, are the practices and values which exist in the society, even if constitutions are undermined and attacked by radical right politicians and governments. So I think this distinction between values, practices, and institutions allows us to see that constitutions themselves are social processes. Constitutions may be seen as processes of social education also. They are not just ready-made documents, right? So if you take the German constitution from 1949, it was initially just an imposed part of legal order, but it allowed to change this German society over time, over several decades. And the German society really changed because the new institution, the new constitution, transformed into new practices and values. So in Poland, we have a different process. We have a kind of institution which has been attacked, but certain values and practices are also present in the society. And we can see a kind of, you know, historical education, I would say, which may be exemplified by exactly this, this phenomenon of radical right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Historical, maybe constitutional education, I would add. Okay, I would like to actually connect to one of the points that Michal just now make about constitutions as values and social practices, and our, as I promised, our, the interest of our project in, let's say, historicizing somewhat the debate. We know that, you know, rule of law and constitutionalism was a central point of the democratic transition. It was, in a way, really unquestioned. They were on throughout the political spectra in the 1990s. You would really find only very minor political actors in the countries we are speaking about who would question it. It was quite clear it is important for creation of pluralist political spectrum, for introducing the market reforms, for integrating with EU, etc., etc. Now it is the central bone of contention, at least in two of the countries, and potentially also in many others. My question is in a way simple, but subversive. Why? I mean, what's the main reason? Renata mentioned here already the maybe weak social embeddedness of the institutional reform. Of course, I mean, you do institutions and you have to wait for a couple of decades to in order to then for the constitutionalism to get to these sort of social practices. So is it this weak social embeddedness? There are many theories about, like, especially Hungary and Poland, long waiting for its constitutions. Okay, Poland not so long as Hungary, but still, I mean, constitutions that were not there. Therefore, we came, or Hungary and the constitutional court came with the invisible constitution concept, etc. So, I mean, this was also one of the issues. Or there are people who say the other way around. They say, like, yeah, actually, this is because Poland and especially Hungary were actually very successful in sort of creating the liberal constitutionalist framework. The Hungarian Constitutional Court was for such a long time such an unquestioned authority in Hungarian political and public life. So yeah, easy question to you all, why we have now the rule of law as a really central bone of political contention in these two countries. Who would like to start? Adam, yes, I was thinking about you.
Yeah, thank you. I think it is a very, very good question. Why it happened? In my opinion, there are two major reasons behind this. I think when there was already a period of beginning of the transformation in the 80s with the birth of the Solidarity Movement, by the way, today is the birthday of 79th birthday of Lech Wałęsa. I think there was a lot of discussion what to do when the change in power comes. And Solidarity Movement was not only about fighting for social rights, but it was also about creating some new institutional dimension. You know, even already in the 80s, there were such special legislative units affiliated with the Solidarity Movement that have prepared a lot of texts of different laws. In my opinion, one of the reasons for this was that we had some significant group of scholars that were heavily interested in creating the Polish state upon resemblance of some Western democracies. Please note that such countries like Poland and Hungary were not closed totally for the external world. There were scholar exchanges, and for example, a number of Polish constitutional architects were properly trained at different scholarships by Humboldt Foundation. Or in the United States. Interestingly, my boss, Professor Wyrzykowski, has spent a lot of time in Austria, and he was one of the persons who was behind creation of the constitutional court, but also of administrative courts already in the 80s. That was a breakthrough in Poland, you know, to start with the Supreme Administrative Court to operate in the beginning of 80s. So basically, when 89 came, this institutional thinking continued. It was simply quite natural that, okay, you started with the administrative court, constitutional court, ombudsman, tribunal of the state. So now it is the time to make it real, to stabilize it, to institutionalize it. But there was like another connection with this, because starting from 1989, there was one primary political objective that was supported by all political actors: joining European Union. But joining European Union was not just a question of some political ambition of, you know, joining the group of democracies and so on, but it was regarded as this kind of a big civilizational step. So this, you know, and Renata has mentioned about our generation. I don't know how Renata perceives this, but for me, this European Union was kind of a like a symbol of you know, of being rich, of being developed, of being of getting out of, you know, all those troubles that were connected with the communist regime. So everything was subordinated to join European Union, to make this accession as soon as possible. Of course, Council of Europe was in the meantime NATO, obviously, but at the same time, European Union had also this institutional dimension and institutional thinking about joining by other countries of the EU. I mean here, Copenhagen criteria. So from the beginning of 90s, it was clear that you must be rule of law country in order to join the EU. And moreover, European Union was really checking this, whether you are progressing with all those reforms, whether everything is going in a proper direction. So the whole political elite was acting in this way. But what does it mean? It means that you are behaving, I mean, political actors are behaving rather in a way that you are this kind of a pupil that would like to have good grades in a school, but it does not mean that this pupil really remembers all the lessons that should be in your mind, that should be in your body, that should be in your consciousness. And that is why it was quite striking that if you look back in those 90s and later on, that there was no so much passion and energy towards creating this internal understanding of principles, civic consciousness, why rule of law matters. So so this kind of institutional structure has been created, and Poland joined the EU. And interestingly, just after joining, we had already some first crises, situation with the first Law and Justice Party that was already started to undermine some basic features of the membership in the European Union. There is a very good book by Wojciech Sadurski and Leonardo Morlino about this democratic backsliding after the accession. So this accession was a little bit on credit because at the same time, European Union did not have skills, did not have instruments to check whether you really believe in those values, whether all those values are shared by the society. So so that is how I would read it. You know, I think that on the one hand, you had this whole generation of scholars, thinkers, lawyers that were going into this direction. On the other hand, you had this joining of the European Union created this drive towards institutional dimension of the accession and respect towards rule of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much too. Edith?
Thank you. And before I allude on that, let me respond to what Renata said about formality, informality, and like what matters or what's more important. I wanted to make it clear that I don't think that informal distortion of democracy is the bigger problem. I was just trying to explain that I think from the perspective of the constraining role of the European Union and the struggle which is ongoing with addressing how to addressing what to do with these countries, this is something which is definitely problematic, and there are no answers to how to, you know, how to bridge this kind of a gap. And back to the question that that was raised, I think it's really worth bringing in the issue of populism, as was mentioned by Michał. This is again another paradigm throughout which we can try to assess or explain what is behind democratic and rule of law backsliding in our region. And I think it was super successful what Fidesz and PIS was doing in terms of riding a wave of delegitimizing the democratic transition and generating anxiety about how it was unsuccessful and why a new kind of liberal transition, however we say it, is needed. And this kind of populist authoritarian remodeling was was happening by them saying that checks and balances, getting to your question, checks and balances are, so to say, obstacles to get things done for the people. So that was the reasoning behind it. That was how they were rationalized what they were doing. They were explaining that, you know, the democratic institutions are not the right representatives of the right people. And that was the justification behind why they were capturing them, especially the judiciary, but not only the judiciary, many other institutions. And if you remember what Viktor Orban said, for instance, in 2014, he was explicitly saying that checks and balances, this is like, it makes sense probably in America, but it definitely doesn't make sense in Europe because, you know, we don't have this kind of directly elected president. We just have, you know, we have the parliament, which is making decisions, period. And also the way how Jaroslaw Kaczynski was explaining it throughout the legal or constitutional impossibilism. I think it was a very similar thing that he was trying to argue that, you know, in order to push through the reform for the people, for you, so to, we're going to raise Poland from the knees and the, you know, the working blue collar workers and so on and so forth. We would like to do that, but given that we have checks and balances, you know, it slows things down. So that was the kind of the whole rationale behind it. And why it's important is that this was the way how they were also explaining later on to the European Union that, you know, rule of law, it's like technically it's a myth. It's a Western imposition. This is some shady business we wouldn't need to be deal with because it's not, you know, underpinned by legally underpinned so that we could stick to it. And end of the day, this is how Viktor Orban also captured the expression of illiberal democracy as a positive notion. He was starting to pursue it in 2014, which is clearly an oxymoron. I mean, from the normative perspective, like talking about illiberal democracy as a positive notion, like, you know, depriving democracy from the liberal kind of underpinnings of protection of minority rights, constraints on the executive, or, you know, the democratic self-governance of the people. This is like, it doesn't make sense. If you deprive it from, you know, the liberal underpinnings, it's just, you know, democracy as a, I would say, like a facade or a charade. So to sum it up, what I wanted to point at is that, I think end of the day in these countries, populism and democratic backsliding, they're mutually reinforcing each other. So we've been seeing how the governments are doing this kind of toxic polarization between, you know, dividing the society between us and them. And this way, they're also polarizing the institutions, capturing the institutions. And yeah, and that's technically the problem we're dealing with. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Don't mind, because this question about embeddedness is so lovely, but the really it's I think if we dig too deep about this, we will mislead ourselves. So let me just go to the land of the rule of law, which is the UK. When a recently perfectly well elected prime minister. So just think of the UK, the land of the rule of law, right? When it is, and I'm not saying that in a sarcastic manner, homeland of Dicey and the rule of law. When the prime minister doesn't like the judgment of the Supreme Court, which tells him that it was a relatively bad idea to mislead the Queen, the prime minister decides to campaign on a wholesale reform of judicial review and the power of the courts to hold the executive in check. A few years later, when certain people who reached the judicial retirement age would wish to sit on the Supreme Court, the judicial retirement age for the Supreme Court is changed in order to be able to seat particular people on that court. I'm not talking about Hungary, I'm not talking about Poland, I'm not talking about Eastern Europe, I'm talking about the UK. So when it comes to embeddedness, the older I get, the more careful I become. To answer about how we ended up in the pickle, I would say that it's partly a historic accident. So the two points where the Hungarian government started to move very fast, one was media and mostly ownership changes, and the judiciary. So anyone at that point in the same mind looking at European responses was looking at the treaty, was looking at which value could we pick. They could choose from democracy, the rule of law, human rights, human dignity and equality. Democracy wasn't the right one because this was done by a properly democratically elected government. So because it was the judiciary, they went for the rule of law. And, you know, I think they felt reasonably safe because we thought that there was enough flesh on the bone, that we know about judicial reform. There was a lot of the Copenhagen criteria and meeting them required a fair bit of judicial reform. We thought that there was more to it. It turns out that the rule of law is as fuzzy a concept in practice as in academic circles. So in a way, that the best possible and most naive interpretation is that the good lawyers in who decided to go with the rule of law labor really believed that they were choosing something that was safe and quick and easy, and it crumbled at the on their hand. And so this is the point where to quote another locally famous academic, Martin Krieger is terribly helpful. Where in about the time when the rule of law was falling apart, he was saying that the rule of law does have a teleological and an anatomical dimension. And if you focus on the anatomy too much, the checklists, you won't capture it because the formal criteria are extremely easy to meet. And on the formal criteria, rule of law and rule by law do not differ that much. So the forms do not, it's the practices that matter. And it's actually the aspirations behind the practices that matter, that you really want the law to restrict, to limit, to temper, to constrain government action in defense of individual liberty. And so that's a very important lesson from the beginning, which scholarship could see. But practice prefers checklists to measuring aspirations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would like to add one observation about the crisis of democracy in Poland after EU access, actually, because I agree that with Adam Bodnar that the crisis began actually long ago, shortly after the access. And it's an interesting question. Why are actually East European countries like Poland and Hungary especially vulnerable to these radical right emergence, right, and actions of this kind of political movement? And actually, it's interesting. I see this discussion already taking place in Poland among sociologists and historians, the discussion about the, let's say, deficits of Polish or Hungarian societies or political systems. And what I see are actually two theoretical frameworks at work. The first is the modernization theory, the modernization framework, which says that Poland and Hungary are modernizing societies, but are more deficient in the modernizing process. They are too slowly and not modern enough, let's say. The other framework, the dependency framework, which describes Eastern Europe as periphery, where more people are excluded from certain privileges or economic development. And these two frameworks are pretty old, and I think neither of them is right, actually, because you can show a lot of counterexamples, like United Kingdom, right, like Eastern European countries where the political system is not as deficient, or you can demonstrate that there are large groups in Poland opposing the radical right. I think the radical right has no majority, in fact, in Poland. So I think the most important, the best explanation would be the following. Political radical right in Poland and Hungary was more able to use certain cultural resources which were at hand here. Sometimes polarizations from the 19th century, like the nationalist Catholic discourse, which allowed them to establish a kind of authoritarian regime. And this kind of discourse was more available or found more public in Eastern Europe, perhaps, than in Western countries. But that's just my hypothesis, right?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we wanted to compare Hungary and Poland, and we already have had a lot of comparative points, but then I would maybe like to expand it a little bit more. We see, of course, and we know it, and you all do it in your work, we see that the questioning of this basic liberal democratic framework and rule of law is happening also elsewhere, everywhere around the globe. Renata was pointing to many of these cases and others too. My question is still, I mean, we are talking about a region that came out of communism, that went through transition, that went through the EU accession process. So in what ways this region of East Central Europe is specific, given that actually what we see in Hungary and Poland is a decomposition of rule of law after relatively, if not actually very successful implementation of the democratic Rechtsstaat, right? There might be Putinist inspiration or Chinese inspiration, but this, you know, Putin's Russia is very different. This is a disaster of the 1990s and of Yeltsin's time inability to introduce the rule of law, to which the Putin on the basis of which the Putin regime is building up. In Hungary and Poland is the other way around. This is a very successful sort of liberal transformation, which is being decomposed. So what is it? Is it specific? And maybe I would have a special sub question to Edith and Michał, because you point a lot to the populist sort of resources. But my question would be, what did the Liberal Democrats did wrong in the 1990s? Did they do something wrong, or was there a problem also in the construction itself? Or is it really mostly the populist attack that is guilty? Whoever wants to start, Michał. Okay. No, I think it's absolutely. Adam?
Yeah, I can start with this, because I think this is really fascinating question, if I may. Because, you know, I stopped a little bit when you mentioned that it was a very successful transformation. Because if you ask about the reasons of the collapse of this liberal democracy, it is one of the reasons that it was not so successful. Or at least not so successful to everybody. So, you know, even if we look into the scholarship, you know, I think on the one hand, Jarosław Kujisz and Karolina Wigura, you know, they I think everybody knows them because they publish a lot in and they present their views in the international press. They claim that all those institutional reforms were made to a great extent superficially. That if you look deeper into the substance, then you see that something is not working. So, you know, on the one hand, you have a great, you know, constitutional court that is delivering wonderful judgments that are at the scholar quality, like the Bundesverfassungsgericht. But then if you look deeply into the substance of some of those judgments concerning, for example, the relationship between the state and the religion, or concerning some social rights, then you see some kind of, you know, problems with this jurisprudence. Or, for example, if you look into the operation of the judiciary, you have all those elements of institutional independence. But on the other hand, it rarely happened that courts were referring directly to the constitution or were simply resolving some typical human rights cases in a proper way, or they were operating in such a protracted way that Strasbourg had to even invent some new measures how to counteract the length of proceedings in Poland. So that is what I would say, that maybe superficially it looked well, but on the other hand, if you showed some problems, then it was quite easy to attack, that the system is not operating, that people should not be satisfied with the system. So that is the reason. And there is like another scholar, Jan Winczorek, who is a well-known sociologist of law, who is writing, who has published a book that the problem we are having is the problem with so-called access to law or access to courts, in a way that if you have a real dispute, you start to think twice or three times before you go to court, because you are not certain whether this court will deliver you a proper solution in a proper time. So you start to be dissatisfied. Of course, you are respecting values, you are respecting the independence of judiciary, but on the other hand, being a citizen, you would like this court to help you when you have a problem. So that is the first reason. And the second reason I would like to mention, which makes, I think, Polish case specific, and I agree here with Professor Kaczmarczyk that this kind of a politics of identity was an important cause, that it was quite easy, maybe even to refer to some issues of homogeneity of the society, to those, you know, migration crisis that is threatening the Polish identity, that we should kind of have a stronger vision of our history and our historical role in the as compared to other nations of Europe. So that was the tune that was used extensively by the learned justice in a little bit similar way as Donald Trump is doing. But I think interesting point of our transformation is the social equality. So to what extent the transformation was beneficial to everyone? And I think this distinction between rural areas and smaller cities and big cities is the big is an important distinction. Even now, even after so many years, you still feel this that this distinction exists. And interestingly, you have also it has a certain consequence which creates a strong difference between Poland and Hungary. We didn't mention this. Local self-governments are almost totally in big cities, or I would even say middle-sized, bigger cities, all of them are controlled by the opposition or by some independent mayors, while all the smaller cities and rural areas are predominantly controlled by the law and justice party. So the social equality is also a consequence of the transformation, because in those more vulnerable regions or more vulnerable environments, people basically were much more ready to accept populist argumentation of the law and justice party. So my point is that this successful transformation was not successful from the institutional point of view, because those institutions didn't deliver proper results. So this output legitimacy was not strong enough. Second point, because it did not deliver equitable results to all members of the society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you actually answered a lot of the questions that I put to Edith and Michał, but Edith.
Thank you. It's a very complex question, but it's great because I could actually link again informal power to populism. So how it makes the region outstanding is that, you know, we've been discussing back and forth the issue of organizational clientelism and corruption. What we haven't really been elaborating on was the electoral clientelist kind of side of the problem. So the way how the society is clinked and bended under the will of the government throughout different kind of informal tools. And I think this is part of the problem, because in Hungary, it eventually translated into coercive vote buying at some point. So what one of the things that make the government very successful is that they announced that they're gonna, and it's a very paternalistic populist kind of way of doing things, that they said that they're going to build a work-based society, which is going to be based on work. So we're going to help the poor without handing over social, you know, kind of handouts, but we are providing the opportunity for them to work, which means that there is this program which has been hugely over-politicized in Hungary called the Workfare Program. This is something which is a tool in the hand of the government and local mayors to get out the vote and to make people the most deprived to vote for them. So I think this is something which is kind of makes, because we have been touching up on the differences between Poland and Hungary, the coercive way of doing it, I think that's what makes a difference in Hungary. According to my research, I haven't been, you know, finding any data which would have shown that there is like explicit coercive vote buying and intimidation when it comes to Polish electorate, but, you know, further research might be needed in order to do that or to prove that. But the thing is that end of the day, and here's where I'm linking informal power to populism, is that the government is differentiating also like horizontally between the deserving and the non-deserving people. So there is a lot of polarization this way by saying that, you know, we're preferring to provide handouts to those who are the deserving good people, like married, Catholic or Protestant, whatever, but definitely not the LGBTQ or the single or those who are, you know, having children at the end of the day. So it's very much like having this kind of very exclusive edge of approach. And I think we can also witness that in Poland. And but getting back to the problem of how we get there and what could have been the kind of the structural incentives that the society was, I would say, becoming more and more acceptable towards this kind of complex approach. And I would pinpoint to two things. One of them is a very post-communist kind of heritage, or we can embed it into that, which has been always the lack of division of power, especially throughout the communism, or this kind of very blurred line between private and state. We can also mention, I think, the privatization issue and, you know, how it has been exposed towards corruption. And very importantly, this has been mentioned by my great panelists before, the low level of trust, interpersonal trust, like, you know, lack of social capital, I think, which have been hugely contributing to this kind of authoritarian populist turn. But this is only one side of the problem. And we have been also talking about the problem with the post-transition period and accession to the European Union. And Renata was mentioning the issue with the societal component of not being ready for this kind of reforms, thus democratic market economy kind of, you know, changes that were pushed by the European Union. I was mentioning before the issue of lack of law enforcement. And I think this is something which is like hugely like problematic in a sense that our countries have been providing this kind of efforts on an industrial scale to be able to apply and to, you know, to get the green light and to be applicable to the Copenhagen criteria. But the European Union didn't have the capacity or the will to check whether implementation and law enforcement actually happened in these countries. So this is why we are facing these kind of problems nowadays. And I think this is something which is not going to go anywhere within the European Union. I mean, the Western Balkan countries, which are queuing in line to join the European Union, are showcasing exactly the same problem with clientelist corruption, with, you know, abuse of state fund and media capture and so on and so forth. And the problem is that I'm afraid that the European Union is not reflectable enough. I mean, we're not really focusing on not doing or reproducing the same problems all over again and again. But still, there is a lot more focus on the box-ticking mentality and to do things good on paper, but not at the end of the day checking whether this is actually making a change in the ground and it's being enforced or not. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Yes, thank you. I would like to return to the issue of the 90s and the transformation. Well, I to answer your initial question, actually, I think the transformation of the 90s was not flawless. Well, but on the other hand, the indicators like the average income, right, increased in a spectacular way. So the economic success of the Polish transformation in the 90s and 2000s was so spectacular that actually, Poland became famous in the world for that, and even such indicators like Gini coefficient started to decrease in the 2000s, right? I think, it's kind of a puzzle why, for example, Kaczyński convinced so many voters that it was actually a wrong path in the 90s, taken by some neoliberals who led Poland to ruins, right? But it's kind of a puzzle. It seems to me that we should look for really cultural discursive explanations for that phenomenon, not really economic explanations. If you take really all these economic indicators seriously, I mentioned. But I think There is also another phenomenon, another issue which may play a role in the explanation why the rule of law has been undermined in Poland, namely certain mistakes of liberal governments in Poland before law and justice came to power. I think the liberal governments shared certain illusions, which are typical illusions of many democratic governments. Namely, first, that there is some kind of majority in the society which understands what the rules of democracy are and how democracy really works, what the rule of law is, what the task of the judges is. I think that's a kind of illusion, because of course democracy is based on the principle of majority, but it doesn't mean that there is a majority acknowledging these rules, right? That's something different. And another illusion, which Hannah Arendt already mentioned in The Origins of Totalitarianism, is the conviction of many liberal politicians that the people who are not interested in politics, who are apathetic, this kind of people don't matter politically. That this kind, the people who are apathetic are just indifferent, not important from political point of view. But that's exactly the main mistake, because these are the people for whom the radical right, who are enlisted by the radical right for a certain political role. And I think these two mistakes were clearly made by Polish liberal governments before law and justice came to power. First, the illusion that there is a majority supporting democracy, and second, the illusion that those who are not interested don't matter, right? And finally, it came to the point when younger people were naturally interested in politics. Now they are getting more interested because they see what are the dangers of radical right.
Thank you very much, Renata.
So let me challenge you a little bit about East Central Europe being the hotbed of the decomposition of the rule of law, because frankly, I think that 10 or so many years ago, we just jumped on a pretty steadily moving train, because the way I will put markers for serious global decomposition is first of all 9/11, because with the rise of the anti-terror state, you have the expansion of unchecked executive powers. You just give a different name to torture. You call it all kinds of funky interrogation. Illegal renditions become normal. Extraterritorial placement. You use rental space to torture people indefinitely, and then cut them from access to courts. You use black sites. And I'm mentioning this because the person who knows the most about it is in the room without virtually. So that's part of decomposition, and the economic crisis was the second big element where legal rules and existing constraints had to be broken in order to keep economies afloat, both in Europe and also in the US. So when we talk about the decomposition of the rule of law, it's hardly the specialty of East Central Europe. These are global trends where even formal compliance with rules seemed superficial in order to get deals done and have separate treaties within the EU in order to manage the economic and the financial crisis. But and I just because I'm a good Hungarian, we need a little bit of depression in the room and a little bit of intellectual self-flagellation. So when we speak about the success of liberal democracy in the region, there is a fair bit of self-deception or wishful thinking. Because we were frankly unwilling to see the signs of imperfection. So joining the EU and delivering on the deliverables disabled the local political elite's capacity and even the pretense of having to do political agenda setting on their own. because you were meeting deadlines, parliaments turned into voting machines without proper debates. This is actually the famous Sadursky-Molino project, which Adam and I both participated in. And we were extremely unpopular in the room when we were saying that there are imperfections that you need to pay attention to, because, you know, we were in the early 21st century before 2010, and we were just saying things that were unpopular. And frankly, when in 2010 Fidesz comes into power, they don't have any money to do populist politics. They have to move into a symbolic space, and they have to move into a symbolic space where there is a combination of at the time very unpalatable nationalism. And what they mobilize on, and this is where I'm coming back to Mikhail saying that, you know, they mobilized cultural resources. What they mobilized was not the interwar fascist rhetoric. They mobilized narratives of victimhood, the losers of transition who lost because of Brussels. And they are mobilizing the exact same existential anxieties, which also resonate in the Philippines, resonate in the US, resonate in France, and frankly resonate in Italy. So I think that when we are looking into which cultural resources they are mobilizing, they might be making symbolic references to Horthy and good heroes, but many of the Fidesz heroes are actually only known to history buffs. What they ride on is existential anxieties and a strong sense of victimhood. And the point from Arendt, it's not only totalitarianism, but also the human condition, where she distinguishes loneliness and solitude very, very clearly. And what all these references, which you keep mentioning about acting in the name of the good people, the right citizen, that creates a sense of belonging and togetherness. Which is absolutely puppet theater, because you have extremely lonely, isolated people, and these regimes are happy so long as you don't have interaction, so long as loneliness translates into apathy and inaction, so that plebiscitary leadership can thrive on talking about the people without actually having to see a few of those people talking to each other in the tiny circles of liberty that are left.
Great, thank you very much. I mean, apparently we could go on, but we are discussing and debating now for more than an hour. So I think this is the highest time to start opening also to the the broader forum, so to say, and I don't know, how do we proceed? I mean, we have the mics, so go on. Just if you, we are just small number of us here, so just like if you can introduce yourself and tell the question, comment.
Hello, I'm Michał Stambulski. I have a question about something that I missed in all of those interesting comments. Could you share something about your thoughts about the political economy of illiberalism? One of the selling points of the rule of law was the stabilizing factor in investment. If we look at the international investment law, having equal treatment and predictability connected with investment was one of the selling points of the, which we also are probably the values of the rule of law. But if we now look at the indicators, economic indicators in Poland and Hungary, we don't see any connection between the breakdown of the rule of law and the breakdown of the foreign investment and general wealth of citizens. Probably, I'm not so familiar with the Hungarian case, but in Poland, much more, we see something reverse. Populism or illiberalism in action is making really a certain parts of the citizens' life much better through different distribution programs. So would that mean that rule of law is no longer connected with the economic or global sphere in the first place, and it's no longer connected with this everyday economic life of citizens? And that would mean that it's rather now problems of lawyers than the citizens themselves. And so my also second question, a small question, would be, what can liberalism learn from illiberalism? What are the good sides of illiberalism that should be somehow transported to liberal mainstream? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. These are great questions. So would somebody like to pick it up? Adam, maybe you?
Yeah, I will do my best. Hi, Michał. Good to hear you. I'm not a specialist in economy, but I will do my best to answer the first question and try to answer the second one. I think what is at stake, and what connects Poland and Hungary, is that by joining European Union, we became the part of the common market. And we can enjoy four freedoms: free movement of goods, persons, capital and services. And in my opinion, for investors, as long as we are there, it doesn't really matter whether standards are a little bit higher or a little bit lower, because still it makes access to a huge market. And it makes possible to enjoy a lower cost of labor and access to some kind of dispute resolution mechanisms. And it seems to me that those dangers concerning rule of law were not high enough for the investors and for the business community. Those dangers concerning rule of law were not high enough to, let's say, overtake benefits stemming from the free movement and the value of the common market. I think it is one of the, you know, we know well that one of the reasons for the success of Viktor Orban and the continuation is so-called German automobile industry. And please note, Orban knows exactly how to play with this. And even and what I would even argue that even the suspension of the recovery funds, maybe even cutting some of the EU money, is not such a big threat as long as you are still part of the common market. And it seems to me that that is the reason for the success of those countries, that they know, I mean, in terms of promotion of the authoritarianism, that they know that as long as they will keep in this free common market zone, they will be able to live up to promises, and the economy will not suffer so much, and there will be still some kind of investment because you are in and you are not out, and it is less risky to invest here, and you may always calculate the cost of that maybe those countries are not so rule of law abiding as they were before. So that is how I would read it. What we may learn from illiberalism, I don't know whether it is the learning from illiberalism, but I think what we may learn from this whole thing that happened is that we have to take care about our rights, about our freedoms, and we have to really spend a lot of time on explaining the value of the institutions for the life of the regular citizens. And second, we should take into account that the whole world does not end up with civil and political rights, that we should take care about also social rights, and we should treat them seriously. And that's why, in my opinion, you cannot overcome the problem without, for example, addressing such issues like lack of access to social housing, abusive labor practices, or even, you know, some maybe abusive practices regarding consumers. So you must take into account also the social agenda in order to really fight with illiberals. Thank you.
Thank you, Renata.
Two or three quick points, and I'm so grateful to Adam for mentioning the German automobile industry, because with as a starting point. So, first of all, when it comes to these regimes and their political economy, there are real economists who explain their nationalizing and central planning tendencies, and the repolonization of certain industries is as popular as in Hungary the same assets getting into friendly hands of friends and family, a type of oligarchic regime. But the foreign investments which you see are attracted on the basis of individual deals which are regularly renegotiated. These are bilateral again, and you select your business partners. The Hungarian economy is at the moment taking a terribly big hit from the war in Ukraine because of the special relationship with Russia and access to gas, and this explains the Hungarian stance on EU sanctions by a mile. What you also look at in terms of how the Hungarian government is trying to boost economic performance is joining Belt and Road, which is a big Chinese program, and we know how beneficial it is to the economy of the size of Hungary. So you might have the select layer of the middle classes who have been doing well until now, but it's going to be a terribly cold winter. And so the second remark here is that the relationship between rule of law and economic success, this is something that has been taken for granted. And if you ask a serious World Bank economist, they will tell you that there is absolutely no proof that the economy is going to do better with rule of law. It's very clear that predictability and rule by law does good for economic progress. And this is what we have seen in Singapore and with the Little Tigers, and also China understands that a certain degree of rule by law and predictability yields economic success. And going back to my earlier point about own self-deception and showing the success of liberal democracy. So when we were talking about the when we were in this phase of success and liberal democracy in the region, we tend to use the canonized markers of good examples of liberal democracies that did well. So the reference points were France, Germany, the US. And in the meantime, an entire, at least in my field, which is a very, very small tribe, of course, there were all these scholars saying that, you know, East Asia is full of illiberal democracies. They are proudly illiberal. They are not failed liberal democracies. They are proud to be illiberal. And much of the scholarship at the time was simply saying that, you know, because those are non-democracies, those are for someone else to compare. So it's a relatively new trend in for my tribe, and that's partly Adam's tribe, to actually say that it's better. It's time to look at the proud illiberal democracies, because by the time you wake up, constitutionalism, which is the normative ideal behind the aspirational or the teleological label, starts to have its own adjectives. So we are not only having illiberal constitutionalism, but socialist constitutionalism is something you can get really, really good grants for. So part of the learning is just looking outside, and I would say the same thing that Adam said, that you can get order and efficiency relatively easily. It's getting liberty. That's the tough part, and that's what illiberal regimes take out of the equation.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Well, most of the things have been said by Renata and Adam about this issue. And I'm also not an economist, but I think what is worth mentioning is that what Renata mentioned about China and Asia, this Eastern opening strategy, which has been announced by the Orban regime like almost like 10 years ago, that was supposed to serve the role of, officially they wanted to replace this kind of too much of embeddedness within the European Union of when it comes to trade. So they wanted to replace it or diversify the trade routes towards Asia. That's one thing that it wasn't successful. The other thing is that how it mattered was that it provided a lot of opportunity structures for the government to do shady businesses with Asian authoritarianships. So you might remember that once Viktor Orban even said that, and I think this is where it matters, that if the European Union is not giving us the money, we're going to turn to China. So it was explicitly said. But the thing is that at this point, he's just puffing up himself whenever he's mentioning that he would like to get the money from China as a threat towards the EU, because that's, on one hand, this is not possible. The other thing is that he knows extremely well how much we are dependent not only on Germany, but also like from within the European Union. You know, we are trading 80% of our foreign trade is manifesting within the EU. So we have this kind of structural kind of, you know, like I would say structures that we cannot avoid. And the other thing is that this is exactly where, at the end of the day, the Hungarian government, as Renata just said, doing everything in order to keep the Germans, you know, in the house. So providing them with this kind of bilateral opportunities that she just mentioned. Corporate tax is the lowest, I think one of the lowest in Hungary, it's 9%. So this is a very, I would say they're providing the environment which is very favorable for the foreign direct investment. And this is where Daniel Kellerman is speaking about the appeasement problem of the European Union, that they're technically, for economic reasons, they are very vague on rule of law and these kind of issues, because they are trying to, you know, keep these kind of opportunity structures provided by the Hungarian government. The automotive industry is providing 1/3 of the jobs, the private jobs in Hungary. So this is kind of like, I would say, mutually convenient for all actors. And end of the day, I think this is where we have to figure out why the council is setting blind side on what is happening with, you know, the deterioration of the rule of law.
Yes, I would like to add two short remarks. First, regarding the economy, I think populist economic politics is pretty beneficial for citizens in short term, because they get the promised money and privileges. However, it is usually not beneficial in the long term, which you can see on the examples of Venezuela or Greece, and I think on the example of Poland as well. In the long term, the whole society loses economically, and I think it is going on right now in Poland. So that's my answer to the first question. The second, what we can learn, we should distinguish what politicians learn and what voters learn. Because if politicians, liberal politicians, learn from illiberal politicians, it may get worse. I mean, the whole political scene may shift towards right wing. Actually, we see happening it in many countries right now, because political parties work as aggregating voters and groups. So they try to aggregate voters around their program, as many voters as possible. So they have to have general programs, but not too general, right? It's kind of tricky game. On the other hand, the voters can also learn, but they often learn too late, when the authoritarian regime turns into a more totalitarian, completely undemocratic one, right? I am a little afraid that we will see this kind of shift towards totalitarianism in Poland.
Okay, thank you. More questions?
Thank you. Thank you for a fascinating discussion, which gives me a lot to think. I will have a comment and a question. The comment goes to this nexus between economy and rule of law. I would simply add to what has been said, that we are learning now that this notion that a market economy and democracy, liberal democracy, stabilize each other, need each other, and in the long term are the most successful way of doing things is deeply rooted in modernization theory. And it is also deeply rooted in the Cold War, I would say, because at a time when the West was only looking eastward and communism didn't perform very well, you could argue that way and overlook what was happening in China or in Singapore or in Latin America, or say, well, time will show. Now we see that this link doesn't really work. And I think this is this is part of the problem, because then we don't have a practical argument for the rule of law anymore, but it rests only on the moral commitment. It's an end in itself, because we want to protect civil rights and minority rights, and avoid abuse of power. And that gets me to my question, because where do we have to look at if we want to understand what is happening with this, when this moral commitment to the rule of law, where did it collapse? You started in the beginning, Michal, like saying, why did those people who actually fought for the rule of law, why did it become a bone of contention in the elite? So why did an elite consensus break down? And in the course of the discussion we had here, the question shifted more like, how could someone like Kaczynski convince the electorate that the populist thing is the thing to do? So we're looking more at the general populace. The question here would be, what should we look at more? Or is it an interconnection sort of elite consensus being stabilized by what the people believe? Or are the people, are the elites educating the general electorate to be democratically committed? Or how do we see this mechanism? And we have to sort of have some sort of view on it when we try to explain what has actually happened in the last years. Just getting back and forth and saying, well, it's because it didn't, transformation was not really socially successful and wasn't inclusive enough. I think this is always the same discussion. We've had this argument 10 years ago, I would say, and not really much evidence which would prove or disprove it. So I would say we have to be a bit more precise on this question.
Thank you. This is to the question, or this is from different? No, I'm sorry. Okay, then.
Society,
Because when we were talking about, I'm Piotr Cislik, by the way, Institute of Literary Research of the Polish Academy of Science. So when you pose the question, what liberalism can learn from illiberalism, maybe you should. I was thinking, listening to the discussion, that, and exactly focusing on this discussion of why societies got duped into accepting populism, that illiberalism is sort of a mirror of liberalism in the region. And I'm saying this evoking the great historian of the French Revolution, Mona Ouzouf, who has this concept of regenerationism, right? And she says more or less this, liberalism, everybody thinks that liberalism, or this is how the narrative goes, liberalism is a reaction to the French Revolution, to the excesses of the French Revolution, to the terror, and so on and so forth. And yet there is one idea that connects it, and this is regenerationism. And by this, she understands a very simple argument, which says that when you have a revolutionary political process, it must, the process must be in sync with the political culture. If it's not in sync, then the revolution will derail itself. And this Jacobin thinking, this is what the liberals share with the Jacobins. And I think this is something that liberals in the region have totally unprocessed in saying that, in all this, they don't believe in the new man anymore, but they believe in Homo Sovieticus. And the Homo Sovieticus is the same thing as the new man, is the unprocessed, right? Newman. So in a way, it's not about learning from illiberalism. It's more or less looking into illiberalism as if you were looking in the mirror, because the more you talk about the society that didn't make the lesson, that didn't kind of draw, were not the kind of object of embeddedness of the values of liberal democracy, the more illiberalism grows in strength. So yeah, so that's my
great comment. Thank you. With Joachim and Piotr, we got really historical. So I would like to gather a reaction from the panel. Is there any, Renata?
Of course, I mean, Joachim, thank you for the easy way and the easy question. Because you know, I mean, well, something that hasn't been solved in 100 years is going to be solved on this panel. But I do believe that there is a very practical argument in favor of the rule of law that might be in part based in a moral commitment, but it's also terribly practical, and that is. Ultimately, what the rule of law gives you is securing a say in what the common good is. So instead of the common good being determined with reference to tradition or a commitment or the history and achievements of the nation, it's actually the ability to have a say in that and to hold those who you elected to be your politicians accountable. Now, this is terribly practical because it actually requires personal engagement. And I think that where we mislead ourselves a little bit again is that here we are likely to mistake elite consensus for something which we take for granted. And I think that we have taken democracy and a well-functioning democracy for granted for too long, and it's going to be terribly empty to say that democracy doesn't work without Democrats. But the point of any functioning democracy being this engagement and wanting to shape the public good is something which is essential, and it's very practical. It's not just a moral commitment; it's a very practical commitment, and the. In terms of what liberals can learn from illiberals, two things, actually. I think that many of practicing illiberals read more of our heroes than we do. They know our sources extremely well. They read these works well. They just come to different conclusions, while we don't read them, because we just keep regurgitating what we've already known. And I think that something that we can learn from them is reading, and reading a lot more carefully also what they are saying. And the other bit is that we are unwilling to admit that liberalism is both full of very unpalatable traits. It's full of intolerances and full of limits that it likes to impose on others. And liberal democracy is a terribly fragile state of affairs. It gives room to its enemies and enables its enemies to take over. And the type of diverse society we like to live in is actually extremely difficult to hold together in the long run on the basis of liberal principles. Yes, I'm quoting Birkenfelder on you. But let's take it seriously instead of pretend that because he was a disciple of Carl Schmitt, we can rule him out because we need to look in our circles for someone to say something smarter.
This was great advice and for our project too, because this is, I think, something that we want to really explore. Michal.
Yes, I just want to make one point. I'm not used to defend modernization theory. I don't want to do that. However, I'm ready to defend a system theory of society. And I would say it's not that easy that market economy just guarantees the existence of the rule of law and democracy. That's definitely not what modernization theorists like Lipset or Coleman wanted to say. I think they just wanted to say that the market economy is one of the many factors, along with education and specific human relationships, which facilitate, right, the rule of law and democracy. So, as far as I understand the modernization theory, however, one more thing I would add is that the social systems like politics and economy and science are interconnected in a pretty complex way. So you can, for example, you cannot, for example, say there is like one model of market economy. There are different models of market economy, Latin American, I don't know, US American, which is very unequal, for example. There are Scandinavian, more equal market economies. These are all market economies. We actually have only market economies nowadays. And they are so different that it requires a much more complex social research to demonstrate what makes the rule of law more probable and more stable, right?
Great, thank you very much. Adam raised his hand.
Yeah. I wanted to refer a little bit. I don't know whether I will answer those questions correctly, but I think that one of the problems we are having is that we are sometimes using this notion, liberal democracy, as some kind of another political system, another kind of a democracy. In my opinion, it is just a buzzword in order to change the country into a simple authoritarian country. So it is really not very much about creating some kind of a new dimension of interpretation of some democratic principles, but about moving a country into a certain direction when you do not have any way back. You cannot come back from the system to a normal democracy without making a revolution. And I think we should have this in mind, that we are not just talking about some, let's say, deficiencies, mistakes, and that could be repaired and then we'll come back. But this is simply a certain strategy to achieve a certain specific political goal of creating like a stable authoritarian system. And we can, you know, just give examples of some countries from Europe or from other parts of the world, you know, how that kind of systems may later on operate. But what I find quite striking in the Polish context is that quite often when I study the situation in Poland, examples from Latin America are very good ones. Especially this connection, we didn't mention this connection between the state and the church. So this notion of traditional values, Christianity, and creating that kind of a ruling elite in a country. So, you know, when you compare the rule or in some other Latin American countries, you find a lot of similarities. And interestingly, when maybe possibly one day we'll get over with this disease, with this authoritarian disease, once again, Latin American examples of getting back to the democratic countries would be interesting from the point of view of transitional justice. Of course, I don't mean, you know, Pinochet, and I don't mean, you know, abuses of that kind, but attacks on judiciary, attacks on institutions, and different ways of settlement could be quite interesting looking from the Latin American perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a very last quick thought, because I think we're going to be wrapping up very soon. What could we learn from them, or how to utilize on what we have learned, what they're doing? And here I'm happy to cycle back to informality and informal power. I think what certainly, for instance, the European Union as an entity should learn is that in order to address this problem, sometimes you have to do something very similar in a way that you have to insert informal pressure on these actors in the council. And this is something which with Germany we haven't been seeing manifesting so far, or at least if there was, it wasn't successful, we could say, because the outcome we can see. And the problem is that those autocratic minded leaders who are operating with informal power, they are great at symbolic and creative compliances. Viktor Orban is a textbook case. Many times he's coming up with ideas as, look, we're going to solve this problem. This is the issue we're going to do. Right now, you know, that the commission is withholding the recovery funds. They said that we're going to solve this matter by introducing a new anti-corruption authority in the country, which is going to look great on paper. So we're going to be absolutely, you know, like this is the example of the creative or symbolic compliance, which have been, you know, successful for like 10 years. And the problem is that if the Commission is going to say, yes, this is fine, and if the council is going to approve it, we're going to get back again to this kind of problem of making things look good on paper and by getting a round of things informally and not changing the course of action in the country. So I think what really would be great if that's something, I mean, this is really crazy that we get to this point that, you know, they would need to insert some sort of a similar informal approach, but I think that would be something that could help. So Germany, France, and other countries should use economic leverage and political leverage and try to make a change this way in the council.
Thank you very much. As Edith said, and we should be wrapping up. We did not explore many other issues that I think could have been explored on this panel. We can't do it because the topic is really broad. Edit was just mentioning a couple of other panelists this relationship of the like European institutions and what's happening in the countries of our interest. This is of course a huge huge thing, and this is a question to what extent actually now the difficult situations in our countries and other countries in Europe is actually enhancing and helping the European constitutionalism after this big backlash after the constitutional treaty failure really sort of like get alive again. So I think that, you know, as Adam mentioned, the diseases, I think diseases are also chances of recoveries. Let's see what we see in the coming years. Thank you very much to all the panelists for the great inputs. Thank you for the attention. And I think, Marta, in your name, in our name, we can invite the people. Apart from Adam, sorry, you can join with the Zoom, but I'm not sure that this is going to be really fun. So we have a Mfunk.
Yes, well, now we have a wine and cheese and many other things there behind the wall. And yes, Adam, we'll raise a glass in your name. Yeah,
thank you. I will raise at my home too. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.